All right. Hi, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Skyline Studio on this Wednesday morning. And we're going to keep you informed and keep you company and get you through this. We're all going to get through this together. You know, WGN is with you 24-7, and I'm here till 4, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Coming up a little bit later on, at 3:30 every Wednesday morning, we play Know Your Onion. That's where we get two callers. The first two callers will be our contestants. And Tom will read you a news headline, and you have to decide whether it's real or from the funny satirical fake newspaper, The Onion. And if you get a majority of them correct, you win a prize. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're going to talk about 40 years of the word yuppie and then slang terms that no one uses anymore. Kurt Loder turned 75 yesterday, which is insane. So we're going to talk about that and the heyday of MTV. All of that is coming up right here, so please stay tuned. Anytime you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. My next guest is Edward McClelland. He is the author of How to Speak Midwestern, Folktales and Legends in the Midwest, and more. He has currently written a piece that appears in ChicagoMag.com about the fact that the 90s, not the 20s, were Chicago's golden age. And we've got that and much more to talk about with Ted, as we call him. Ted, how are you?
Good. Hey, you know, I have a Kurt Loder story, too, if you want to get to that after we're done with this.
Oh, sure. Sure. Now, how are you holding up in this in this weird quarantined world now?
Well, you know, I'm almost grateful for the terrible weather, because it makes us not want to go outside.
Yeah.
You know, the spring visited us for the weekend, and then it left.
Yeah.
And I don't see it coming back again in the next 10 days. So,
yeah.
So, you know, speaking of the 90s, you know, I'm in here. I'm watching The People versus O.J. Simpson.
So, oh, wow. Yeah,
I think the time for 90s nostalgia is here.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. I really enjoyed that decade very much. And
yeah, I mean, it was a fantastic, you know, decade for Chicago.
Yeah, it really was. And now, is this the reason why you wrote this piece? Is it because of The Last Dance?
Yeah, I mean, it was something that I'd been thinking about actually for a long time, and The Last Dance kind of gave me a hook. You know, because I thought of it as, you know, the decade that sort of made modern Chicago. You know, it was a decade that sort of transformed Chicago. You know, in the 80s, there was talk that, you know, the steel mills were closing down. Chicago was just going to become a Rust Belt casualty like Detroit or, you know, Cleveland or Buffalo.
Yeah.
And I think the 90s were the decade when Chicago really kind of turned that corner and made that transformation to kind of the, you know, the cultural capital it is now. I mean, Chicago actually gained population in the 90s. I mean, that was a decade I moved to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was living downstate in Decatur, which is a city that didn't make it out of the Rust Belt era.
Yeah. Well,
and
go ahead.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was just going to ask you to tell us about your background, yourself, and when you started writing and all that cool stuff.
Well, I mean, let's see. You know, before I moved to Chicago, I was living downstate in Decatur. I worked for a newspaper there. And then I started writing for The Reader in the 1990s. But back, remember when it was huge, it was really fat, and they would just pile up stacks and stacks of readers at the Borders at, was it Diversey and Clark?
Yep.
They'd pile them up there on Thursday, and by Saturday, they'd all be gone.
And then I also love the fact that right outside the offices on Illinois there, the Reader, they would stack tons of them there.
Sure, sure. And they'd be gone in 2 days.
Yep. So you wrote for The Reader. That must have been pretty fun. And then the first book that you wrote, tell us about that one.
Oh, that was Horse Players. Horse Players Life at the Track.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because like literally the year after I moved to Chicago, my dad came to visit. We said, "Oh, let's go to the track." We went to the track, and the worst thing that can happen to you at the track happened to me, which is that I won $150.
Now, was this at Arlington?
Yeah, it was at Arlington.
Okay,
and I couldn't stop. I could not stop going back, and I rationalized it to myself, saying, "Well, you know, if you want to be a writer, I got to have something to write about. And there's all kinds of colorful characters and action going on at the track." And it was actually the subject of my first story for The Reader. I wrote like a 10,000 word cover story about my learning how to play the horses from my mentor, a guy named the late John Goritz from Burbank. I met him out at Sportsman's Park. So that's how I got started as a reader, and that's how I got started in writing books, you know. So that's the writing. That's another unprofitable addiction.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the track. We were talking about the track just a few days ago because I grew up, my dad played the horses a lot. And
did he?
Oh, yeah. And we used to go to Sportsman's. We used to go to Balmoral. We went to Maywood.
So he played the trotters too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I never really got into the trotters.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, so the world of the racetrack is something that I'm very familiar with ever since my childhood. And it's really a lot of fun. Arlington is beautiful. Some of the other ones that we'd go to, not so much.
Hawthorne has a great view of the world's largest sewage treatment plant.
Right, exactly. So it all started with
the very first time I went to Hawthorne.
Yeah.
I walk in there, and who do you think I see standing in the concourse?
At Hawthorne? Who?
Yeah, Governor Jim Edgar. His father-in-law owned a horse, and I figured out that every time he was at the track, this horse won. So, you know, I had a tip, this horse named Lady Doc. And I don't know if it was fixed just for him, but every time I saw him at the track, this horse was running and this horse won.
I was going to say you bet on it all the time then.
Yeah, I bet on it that day, and I made some money.
All right, very good. So the track is where it all started. All right. Ted, hang on, okay?
Okay.
We're going to talk about the 90s. Ted McClellan is a terrific writer, author of books including How to Speak Midwestern and Folk Tales and Legends of the Midwest. And the 90s is what he wrote about, and we're going to talk all about that. And if you want to jump in with your memories of the 90s, it being a great decade for this city and everywhere, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200.
Now, I believe in what you say is the undisputed truth. To keep me in my youth, like a ship without an anchor, like a slave without a chain, just a thought of those pretty ladies as they shimmer through my veins. And I will go on shining, shining like brand new
Magnolia. William H. Macy in the Supertramp bar, as we refer to it. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's a Wednesday morning. Happy Wednesday to everyone. We're here 24/7 at WGN to keep you informed, to keep you company, and to get you through this, and we're all going to get through this together. Edward McClellan, who is a writer and author of the books How to Speak Midwestern, Folk Tales and Legends of the Midwest, and more, is here. Ted, as we call him.
You got to put on some 90s music. It's been all 70s music so far.
Oh, okay.
Since we're talking about the 90s.
Yeah, okay. All right. So we are talking about the 90s, and so the Last Dance is, I think, a lot of people going back and thinking about that about the 90s. And obviously one of the big stories of that decade here in Chicago are the Bulls.
Right. And it was not just what they did for Chicago is, you know, before the Bulls started winning all these titles, if you were Chicago and you went overseas and you said you were from Chicago, what do people say? They said, oh, Al Capone.
Right.
Boom, 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 boom. And then, you know, after, you know, Michael Jordan said it was, oh, Bulls, Michael Jordan. Do you know Michael Jordan? That kind of thing. So, I mean, they really, you know, completely changed the international image of Chicago. And it's interesting that in the 90s, probably two of the most famous people on the planet were living in Chicago, Michael Jordan and Oprah Winfrey.
Yeah.
And somebody who would become more famous than either of them was also living in Chicago. And that was Barack Obama, who started his political career in 1996. He got elected to the state Senate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny that you mentioned the whole traveling overseas, because my mentor, the late, great Roy Leonard, who, you know, was part of this radio station for many, many years, used to travel a lot. He would travel a lot overseas, and they would do trips with listeners and things. And exactly what you said,
right,
is what happened to him several times, and then, you know, like, yeah, it was Al Capone, bang bang, and then all of a sudden it was, right, Michael Jordan, and that he talked about that, how that happened to him in the 90s when he was doing these trips.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, Chicago, I mean, the music in the 90s, I mean, you could argue that at least as an alternative music scene, Chicago might have been second only to Seattle.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we had, you know, the Smashing Pumpkins, we had Liz Phair, we had Urge Overkill, Wilco was getting started, and you know, I mean, Common released his first album in the 90s, R. Kelly.
Yeah.
And R. Kelly feeds into the Kurt Loder story, if you want me to tell that later, too.
Okay. All right.
And I think in that story, I posted a link to the, you know, you remember the Lounge Acts?
Oh, of course I do, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, their website is still live, and they have the last 2 weeks of shows still listed on there.
Oh, really?
Early January 2000. So they had, you know, obviously they had Wilco because Jeff Tweedy's married to Sue Miller, who ran it. And they had, like, I think Tortoise was in there and Shellac.
Yeah.
And of course, that whole, you know, 90s alternative scene was portrayed in High Fidelity, which,
right,
is, you know, my personal favorite Chicago movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was, I mean, that they even had a character in there who worked for the Reader. So
yeah, they did, didn't they? Yeah,
right. Yeah, although I mean, I thought she was kind of sucking up to him more than a good reporter should have. But and one thing I learned, and I didn't know this, was when they put on a song in the store, and they said, "Oh, that's Marita Sal singing." It was actually a Chicago musician named Edith Frost who was here in the 90s.
Okay. You know, you mentioned the Lounge Acts. Have you ever heard the G.G. Allen story from that happened in the Lounge Acts?
I've heard lots of G.G. Allen stories. I don't think I've heard that one, but why don't you tell
it? I will tell you this story. I've told it on the air a few times, but it's a pretty legendary story. For people who don't know, G.G. Allen was a nut. He was a lunatic. He was a punk rock guy who would go on stage and throw his feces at the audience, and he threatened to kill himself on stage and all this crazy stuff. They made a documentary called Hated, the G.G. Allen story, which in fact was directed by the guy who directed the Hangover movies. For real, yeah. So that's just by way of explanation, this guy was a lunatic. He never knew what he was going to do on stage. He was nuts. So he was scheduled to play at the Lounge Acts, and they were doing the sound check around 5 o'clock, you know, in the evening. So nobody was in the bar. They were just cleaning up the bar, taking the stools down, and the sound man is waiting. And you know how sound guys are, Ted. They don't have a lot of patience. They get very angry at, you know. So he's there waiting. G.G. Allen finally shows up. He's loaded. He comes up. He goes on stage. And then he takes off all his clothes. So now he's naked. All right. This is during sound check. Okay. So and the sound guy's like, oh God. So they're trying to do the sound check. G.G. Allen is on stage naked, and then he takes a tray full of glasses and smashes them down in front of the stage. So now there's shards of glass all over the floor in front of the stage. Then he's naked. He stands up on top of the Marshall stack. He's got the microphone. He takes the microphone and sticks it in his butt, jumps off the Marshall stacks into the shards of glass on the floor. Sound guy comes out, walks up to him, and the first thing he says is, "You just bought that effing microphone."
You gotta save it for the show.
Yeah, well, but here's the thing, though. But then the legend has it, because I love that. The sound guy's all upset about the mic. He doesn't care that this guy's bleeding all over the place on the floor.
Right.
But legend has it that they kept the G.G. Allen microphone, and whenever a singer gave them a really hard time or acted like a jerk,
they make some sing out of that one.
They would get the G.G. Allen microphone.
Wow.
Yeah. True story, the Lounge Acts. Crazy stuff. How do you think the city has changed between the 90s and now?
Well, you know, I kind of started talking about how, you know, in the early 90s, I mean, Chicago was not in great shape. I mean, the city actually had its, you know, highest murder count, you know, because, you know, the crack wars were going on then. And, you know, U.S. Steel shut down for good in 92. So, I mean, I just think it's become, you know, coming out of the 80s, I think it was still really, you know, more of a blue-collar city, an industrial city. And I think it's become more of a, I guess, a cosmopolitan city, more of a professional city. I know that I think I had some figure in there about how number of people in professional services went up from like 16,000 to 68,000 between the 80s and the 90s. I mean, it's a city that's sort of now known internationally for, you know, restaurants, you know, because Charlie Trotter was really, really getting started then. And Rick Bayless, I think he opened his first restaurant. Maybe it was the late 80s, maybe it was the early 90s. Steppenwolf, they'd kind of become known in the 80s. I think, you know, the theater scene really became internationally known in that decade. So,
well, they also moved, the Steppenwolf moved to Halsted.
Right.
I believe in 1990 or 91.
Right. Okay. And they had started, I think, then they started in a church.
Yeah.
Basement in Highland Park.
Yes, sir. Church basement in Highland Park. That's how Steppenwolf started. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And go ahead.
The thing that really made their name, and I actually watched this not too long ago, was remember the True West production that was on American Playhouse?
Oh, absolutely. With Sinise and Malkovich.
Exactly. Yeah. I remember seeing that when I was in high school, and I watched it again, and
it was
fantastic.
It's absolutely great.
They were both so perfect for that. It was like Sam Shepard wrote it for them.
Yeah, and it was just one of the greatest. I mean, that seriously put Steppenwolf on the map like that. I mean,
right.
they were obviously locally, they were, you know, established and amazing and, you know, critical darlings and very successful. But when that thing went on PBS, when they showed True West on PBS, that's exactly when Steppenwolf was put on the map.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. So, now in the 90s, you were, when did you move here?
95, right in the middle of the decade. I actually moved here on the day that the heat wave spiked.
Oh, man.
So probably one of the worst events of the 90s.
Absolutely.
I was here for.
Yeah, absolutely. And you had to move?
Yeah, I almost fainted moving my furniture up to my...
I can't even imagine that. I remember
apartment.
I had just, my ex-wife and I, about 3 weeks earlier, had just moved into our apartment in Andersonville.
Yeah.
So we had missed, you know, but we moved in like 3 weeks earlier, and I just vividly remember how horrible that heat wave was. And how many people died?
It was over 500 people.
Yeah. Horrible.
Yeah.
Really, really horrible.
Yeah, yeah. I was living in a place with no air conditioning.
Oh, God.
I had moved in Decatur for $325 a month. I had a two-bedroom house with a basement and a carport, and here for $325 a month, I had a studio apartment with no air conditioning.
Yeah, that's true. Decatur, I believe, it's a little bit cheaper. A little bit cheaper to live in Decatur, I would imagine.
Right.
Yeah, it was a weird time, that heat wave. And we mentioned another things that happened in the 90s. How about in April 13th, 1992, when...
Was that when the deep tunnel?
The loop flooded, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Insane.
Yeah.
Insane.
Right.
I remember laying on the couch watching all the coverage, hundreds and hundreds of people walking across the bridge because they had to leave the loop and get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a crazy, crazy thing.
Well, another thing I was thinking about that led to actually an enormous change in Chicago was, remember that 7-year-old kid got killed, was it in Cabrini Green?
Yeah.
Caught in the gang crossfire?
Yeah.
And you know, they called that I think that was in 92, they called that the shot that brought the projects down.
Mm-hmm.
Because now we don't have them anymore. Remember, you used to go to see the Sox and beyond the outfield wall.
Yep,
all you saw was the Robert Taylor homes.
Right,
gone. Cabrini Green
is gone.
Yeah,
and it was legendary. Cabrini Green was legendary for many reasons,
right.
And one of which is because Jane Byrne stayed there, like she lived there for a while, which was of course crazy.
and it was also where the Evans family would have been living.
Yeah. It's also where Candyman lives from the movie.
Yeah, right. That was inspired by a Chicago Reader story.
It was?
Yeah.
Candyman was? Really?
Yeah, by Steve Bogira. Because it was about taking out the, you know, somebody coming through the bathroom.
Oh.
Because I think that, you know, these things were built so cheaply that, you know, it was like there was like a space between your bathroom mirror and whoever was on the apartment on the other side.
That's right. I totally remember that now. Like the medicine chests were like, yes. Some people were coming through the medicine chest. Oh, that's crazy.
Exactly.
That's so
exactly.
Crazy. All right, Ted, hang on, man.
All right.
Ted McClelland is here, and he has written a story for Chicago Magazine, and you can check out chicagomag.com. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the 90s and what it was like for this city then. And if you want to reminisce about the 90s and the effect that it had on this city and that time period, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Phone lines are open. All right. Hi, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are here to keep you company and to keep you informed and to get through this, and we will. 312-981-7200. 40 years of the word yuppie we're going to talk about, and we've got some slang terms that no one uses anymore. Kurt Loder turned 75 yesterday, so we're going to talk about that and then the heyday of MTV. Right now, though, Ted McClelland is with us. Edward McClelland is the name that he writes under. Author of many books, and he wrote a story for Chicago Magazine. You can check out chicagomag.com. The 90s, not the 20s, were Chicago's golden age. All right, Ted. Hey, you know, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
What is it about the Midwest that you find so compelling and fascinating that you write about the Midwest in general? What is it about this area?
I guess it's just where I was born and raised. You know, I actually grew up in Michigan, and then I moved over here to the other side of the lake.
Yeah.
I guess if I were from New England, I would probably find New England fascinating and compelling. Or if I were from the side, I like, you know, regional writing no matter where it's from, and this is the region that I'm from. So I always say to my writing advice is tell the story that only you can tell, and I figure I can write about the Midwest as well as anybody. So
yeah,
this is what I do.
What part of the Mitten were you from?
Lansing, right in the middle.
Sure,
but as far from the Great Lake as you can get.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, ooh. Okay. Yeah. All right.
I was actually just having a '90s flashback here. Do you remember my '90s DJs? Do you remember Lance and Stoli and WXRT?
I do. Yes.
Yes, they were. They were my 90s DJs when I first moved here.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
90s DJs. That's something to, that's a whole nother subplot right there, man.
Right.
Yeah, completely. What was it about you picking these two decades, 90s and 20s? Why those two decades?
Well, I think that, you know, kind of going back to what we were talking about with, you know, Al Capone, you know, I think that in a lot of ways that was probably the teens and the 20s were the decade that had sort of defined Chicago, or you know, they were kind of Chicago's golden age. Because you know, a little bit before I wrote this one, I wrote an article about Hugh Hefner, and you know, when he was growing up during the Depression, he would say, "Well, I look back at the 20s, and I thought I'd miss the party," you know, and Bob Fosse, who grew up in Chicago at the same time as Hugh Hefner. He tried to, you know, revive the 20s in the musical Chicago.
Yeah.
So I think that had been seen as, you know, as a time when the city had peaked, or it was an exciting time to be a Chicagoan. So I'm trying to say that this was an even more exciting time and affected the city even more than the 20s did.
As far as financially, how was Chicago doing in the 90s?
I think the 90s were the decade, and you talked about that article, that yuppie article.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, think about all the construction that was going on in the 90s. I mean, think about how much downtown changed. I mean, you know, one of the guys I talked to, I didn't talk to him for this article, but I talked to him before, was, you know, Gary Chico, who used to be, you know, he ran for mayor, he was Mayor Daley's chief of staff, and, you know, he talked about how the Loop was in the 80s, you know, and it was just, rundown taverns and porno theaters.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said in the 90s, you know, now he lives downtown. In the 90s, they started building condos. People started moving downtown. So I think there was a real, you know, transformation of the center of Chicago in that. That really started in that decade.
I think you're true. I think you're absolutely right, because I grew up going to the grindhouses in the Loop, seeing movies,
yeah.
And this was in the 70s. And I remember in the 80s, it was terrible.
But you go to the Loop now. I think there's one left on Hubbard Street.
Yeah,
I think that's it.
Yeah, it's beautiful down there now. Hey, remember when they decided that only buses could drive down State Street?
Yeah, I think that was probably before.
I think that was the 80s.
Because that would have been before I got here.
Yeah,
I think I've heard that story. And didn't they also try to turn it into a pedestrian mall?
Yeah, absolutely. It was just I don't know, and it just leave State Street alone, man.
Right. I mean, but I do remember when the Pacific Garden Mission was in the South Loop.
Yeah,
and now the South Loop is completely different from that.
Completely, it's amazing. Yeah. Having grown up here, and like I said, we used to go to my father would take me to the movies every Sunday morning, and we would go down to the Loop and go to the theaters that were down there. There used to be like 40 theaters in the downtown area. Now now there's just the Chicago Theater, and that's it. Everything else is gone. But we used to go down to those theaters, and the difference between what it was then.
Didn't the Oriental used to be a movie theater?
Yeah, Oriental used to be a movie theater.
Yeah.
There were theaters everywhere downtown. And, Block 37, there used to be two movie theaters right there.
I think there is a movie theater in there now.
Yeah, well, these were just the big movie houses, you know what I mean? They weren't multi-screened. They were like, 2,000 seats. Beautiful, crazy. And they were in terrible disarray when I went. I mean, there was a...
Right.
By the time in the 70s when I was going, they had a little rodent problem in a lot of them. And, some of them showed triple features of kung fu movies.
But they were starting, like, kung fu movies and blaxploitation movies. Did you see that, what was that, that Dolomite movie?
Oh, yeah. With Eddie Murphy?
And they talked about that. They said this is where you want to show it because, you got these... great theaters, but they're in the inner city, and that's where your audience is.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I grew up watching those movies. By the way, that movie was great, and I really thought that Eddie Murphy should have been nominated for an Academy Award for that performance.
Yeah.
He was great as Rudy Ray Moore. So great.
He was terrific.
Yeah, absolutely. So you wrote a book called Nothing But Blue Skies.
Yeah. And I think, I had a whole chapter in there, and it was called We're All Gonna End Up in Chicago, and that was just something I overheard from a bookstore clerk back in Lansing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember somebody from Cleveland asking me, well, what did Chicago do right? And I think what they wanted to know was, what could Cleveland do that Chicago did? And I don't think it could have done anything because, in this age of globalization, there can only be, one Midwestern metropolis, and Chicago is it.
Oh, yeah.
Chicago, in a lot of ways, has just been kind of sucking the economic life out of the rest of the Midwest. I mean, you think about some of the corporate headquarters we've stolen from other cities, from Decatur.
Yeah,
ADM moved up from Decatur, and I think didn't Caterpillar move up from?
Peoria? I think you're right.
They moved their corporate offices up here. You think about so many college students, so many Big Ten graduates. You go to Lakeview, there's a bar for every Big Ten school. The best educated people from every Midwestern state are all moving to Chicago.
Nothing But Blue Skies. Tell us about what that book's all about.
I guess you could say that's a history of the Rust Belt. I spent time in spent a lot of time in Detroit and Cleveland, Buffalo, Chicago. There are parts of Chicago that still bear the scars of the Rust Belt. You go down to the southeast side, you go to the old U.S. Steel site, which they've never been able to redevelop.
Yeah.
Kind of just looking at the economic changes from the 50s, when this was probably one of the most prosperous parts of the country. I mean, I went to high school across the street from a Fisher Body auto plant.
Mm.
I still remember inhaling the the paint when I was running on the track. And,
yeah.
you know, there were just stories that, you know, you could just walk out the door, walk off the graduation stage and walk right into the plant. This was in the 1970s.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I remember having an anecdote about this guy in my class lecturing his dad about how, well, it's not as easy as it was for my generation as it was for your generation. I just can't walk into a plant and get a job.
Yeah. It's interesting that you talk about, you know, smelling the paint. You know, there was a time in this city when you could smell the stockades on a pretty, you know.
The stockyards?
Oh, yeah. Stockyards, yeah. You could smell the stockyards along.
Oh, yeah. And I heard all kinds of stories from people who lived down in South Chicago, down on the east side, about how the sky would be glowing all night, you know, as they'd be pouring out slag from the steel mills.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't drive your good car to work. Because it would get soot all over it, or you wouldn't put your laundry out. You had to put your laundry in the basement because it would get soot all over it.
Yeah.
And actually kind of got the title from a guy who lived in, do you know the neighborhood called The Bush?
I do. For people who tell everybody where that is and for people who don't know.
It's over by where U.S. Steel was.
Right.
U.S. Steel Southworks was by the main gate. And, you know, he lived all his life there and after the mill shut down, he said I looked up and I saw a blue sky and I thought the world had come to an end.
Yeah.
So that's why I kind of call it nothing but blue skies, because this is what you have left after the factory closes, but it's also sort of a blank slate to invent a new kind of city. But they still have not been able to redevelop that U.S. Steel site. There was talk about putting a new housing and shopping development there, but there's still too much residual pollution. They do have a little park there.
All this time later. Isn't that nuts?
Yeah, almost 30 years.
Isn't that nuts? Wow.
I mean, but how long is the half-life of this stuff that they use to make steel, these chemicals?
Yeah.
Probably a lot longer than 30 years, I'm sure.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. Wow, that's pretty crazy. All right, Ted, hang on, okay?
Okay.
All right, Ted McClellan is with us, and his story in the Chicago Magazine, you can check out chicagomag.com. The 90s, not the 20s, were Chicago's golden age. Right.
Cry every night.
Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 4. After 4, we head over to Bradley Place, to our friends over at WGN-TV, that wonderful group, and we'll get some information and some news from them. And then at 5 o'clock, the one and only Bob Surratt has your morning drive right here on WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Ted McClelland is my guest. He's the author of many books, including How to Speak Midwestern, Folktales and Legends of the Midwest. He's currently got an article that you can read at chicagomag.com, where it's the 90s, not the 20s, that were Chicago's golden age. And here is Ted.
Hey, we didn't talk about Wesley Willis, did we?
Oh, no, not the great Wesley Willis. I've been headbutted by Wesley Willis many times.
Yeah, I think I found a song by him about the Bulls. I mean, that's peak 90s Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. I have many of his homemade cassettes.
Did he do a song about you?
No, he did not do a song about me.
I have a friend who he did a song about. I think that's his... still his greatest claim to fame.
For people who don't know, Wesley Willis was this guy who was a staple in the music bar scenes. And he had mental issues but he would record his own music and sell the cassettes, you know, like at lounge acts or, you know, any of the music places, Elbow Room, all that stuff. And he had this tendency to headbutt you. And he had some mental issues, and he was homeless for a little while. But he was a legend, and he would always end his songs with some sort of like commercial jingle or something.
It was always Rock Over London, Rock on Chicago,
right?
And it was like Blockbuster, make it a Blockbuster night.
That's exactly right. He would,
and he always used the same pre-programmed, I think, Casio VL tone.
Yep. Yep,
music for all of his songs.
Yeah, no, he was a legend. He was an absolute legend. Everybody loved Wesley, man. Everybody loved the guy, and it was so great. And yeah, I was headbutt by him several times.
Yeah, but we can't talk about the Chicago music scene in the 90s without talking about Wesley Wilson.
No, you can't. You absolutely can't. Here's Rob on WGN. Hi, Rob.
Yeah, how you doing?
All right, what's up?
No, I just wanted to... You guys were talking about the kid who got killed at Cabrini Green, and I think it was 1992. His name was Dan Charles Davis.
Yeah.
I was over there by a school just north of Division Street.
Yeah.
I worked up there as a policeman, so I know the area. And I just wanted to let you guys know that was his name.
That was his name.
That was kind of the end of the project. You guys are right.
It really was, yeah. Yeah, interesting time.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
All right, Rob, thanks for your service, buddy. I appreciate it. Here's Linda on WGN. Hi, Linda.
Yeah, good evening. You talking about Southeast Side. I grew up there. Not only was U.S. Steel closed, but Wisconsin Steel.
Wisconsin Steel. Yeah, that closed in 1980, yeah.
Yeah.
Interlake. There was a couple of others. The coke plant on Torrance Avenue, where they put the coal and stuff and would burn it and break it down. Also in there, you had General Mills. And when they would make their Cocoa Puffs and stuff, you could smell it all over the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You could smell it all over the place. And that's like when you were, if you were going to get on the Kennedy back in the day and you were going down Ontario to get on the Kennedy, you could smell nothing but chocolate because they had the chocolate factory right there and it was just thick in the air.
And when the steel mills start closing and Solo Cup left the area, Jay's Potato Chips left the area, a lot of different little companies left. South Chicago was one of the best places to go shopping.
Yeah.
No matter what you needed.
Commercial Avenue, right?
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, it's like the little Orient, almost.
It's like a cell phone store and a T-shirt store. That's about all
there
is.
That's pretty much it. Yeah, yeah. And that used to be such a vibrant, vibrant community. Linda, thank you for the call. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Okay, what was this Kurt Loder story that you wanted to tell?
All right, well, this has a Chicago connection because back in 2008, I covered the R. Kelly trial for a magazine, now defunct magazine called Blender.
Sure.
And MTV sent a reporter there, not one of their, just like somebody for the blog.
Yeah.
And, I got to know her and I got to be friends with her. And when I went to New York, I visited her and she's like looking at her phone and I just glanced over there and I saw she's got Kurt Loder on her speed dial. and I said, oh, you got Kurt Loder on there. She said, oh, yeah, that's my boyfriend.
What?
So they live together. So we go back over to her house and, they actually, their apartment, they have like a one bedroom apartment.
Yeah.
She said he was terrible with money. You know, he'd go out and buy dinner for everybody. She finally got his spending under control. But, it's just this, it's New York. It's Greenwich Village. So it's one bedroom apartment. And he was like writing a movie review for the MTV website. I don't think he was doing much on TV at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, pretty much like you'd expect, pretty much a pretty chill, avuncular guy. But everyone's freaking out because he's 75. But I mean, but he was always the old guy
On MTV. Yeah, no, he was elder. He was the elder statesman. He was definitely the elder statesman. Yeah,
exactly. You know, he was the serious.
Yep.
Serious guy.
Yep.
Who he'd been around.
Yeah. His pedigree. I mean, he wrote about music for a long time. He wrote classic
for
Rolling Stone, wrote classic pieces for Rolling Stone. So he had, he had a legit reputation when he started working with MTV.
Yeah. And I think that's why they brought him in, because he was somebody who had come from print, who hadn't come from radio or hadn't come from TV.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit about now. So obviously the article that we're talking about is the 90s, not the 20s, were Chicago's golden age. Let's talk about Richard Daley, Richard M. Daley. How do you feel he did as mayor, and what were some of the more memorable things that he did during that decade?
Well, I mean, I kind of like to say that he helped transform Chicago from the, industrial city that, his family's dynasty was born in to the, kind of the international city that it is today. I mean, while one thing he did was he bought the Democratic National Convention back to Chicago.
Yep.
And they kind of steered clear of the city since 1968.
Yep.
I don't know if you remember this. I remember... going by this uniform store on the northwest side, and there was a T-shirt there that said, we kicked your father's ass in 68. Wait until you see what we do to you. And you know, the cops were selling these things, and they were wearing them. Daily was, of course, really pissed about it.
I don't remember that. That's hilarious.
You remember that?
No.
And they put those sort of like fences over the overpasses downtown, you know, with the stars on them.
Yeah.
So, I think Daly really kind of sought out international investment in a way that his father hadn't. I mean, because Chicago was probably a much more insular city when his old man was
married. Oh, no question.
I think he tried to make it a global city in a way that his father really never had to do.
Yeah. Well, I think the legacy that Richard M. Daly leaves behind is a great one. I really do. And he was a character too.
Yeah.
I have a friend who was covering a story, and he was at a press conference with Daly, and he had like an old rifle. I don't remember.
Oh, yeah. That's when he said he was going to stick it up his butt.
Yeah, and that's my friend. He's going to do that too.
Who was that? Was it McDumkey?
Mick Dumkey, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you worked with him at the Reader, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mick Dumkey was threatened by Mayor Daly to have a rifle stuck up his butt.
Right. he could get punchy sometimes.
He
wasn't the most articulate mayor.
No.
We've ever had, I would say, but you're right. He did have some. I think one year I did, the year in Dalyisms for the readers year end issue. You know, he'd say stuff like, what do you want me to do? Take out my pants? You know, he says, well, stop scrutinizing me. Go scrutin yourselves.
You could always count on Daly for at least one weird thing a week.
Exactly.
That was really memorable. But he did it. I thought he did it. I think you're right. I think he transformed the city. I really do.
Right.
In a very positive way. And I think his legacy is people are going to remember him as a really terrific mayor.
I think people who remember his entire tenure. He kind of gets a bad rap for the He probably stayed one term too long.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe he wanted to break his father's record, but he gets a lot of flack for the parking meter deal. But if you look at the city, he took over and how much racial division there was at the time.
Yeah.
I think that's something that he helped to, cure.
Yeah. And he was also just fun to watch,
right?
On the simplest of levels.
And he promoted the career of Barack Obama, but probably because he wanted to get him out of town. Obama wanted to run for mayor.
Yeah,
that was his plan when he got into politics. Yeah, I want to be a state senator. I want to go to Congress. I want to be mayor.
Yeah,
he wanted to do exactly what Harold Washington did.
Yeah, interesting. So, all right, yeah. Here's Steve real quick. Go ahead, Steve.
Old Man Daly used to love to tear down classic Chicago buildings, like the Stock Exchange building.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful building. I don't know why anybody would, a building by, what was it, Sullivan, whatever.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think his name was Nichols. Remember, he used to go through and try to save parts of the buildings and all that. He was found dead in one of the buildings.
Yeah, it's true.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, all the right. Photographer.
Yeah, Steve, thanks for the call. Ted, always a pleasure, man.
Yeah, all these callers are making me, when Justin Kaufman was on the air, we used to do the Chicago Accent Challenge.
Right.
People would call in with their best Chicago accents. But, you're making it happen anyway with all these people calling it.
So, got it. All right, Ted, thanks, man.
It's always great to be at WGN.
Take care, buddy.
Thank you.
All right, Edward McClellan, you can check out the 90s and not the 20s, where Chicago's golden age, at chicagomag.com.